Welcome to the Ness Podcast, a podcast of the weekly preaching ministry of Ness Avenue Baptist Church, where we seek to equip people to love God and love others.
Well, one of the things I did this week is I did send out just a quick link to within our regular weekly email, and that link just kind of asked this very simple question, like, is it still worth writing things with a piece of paper and with a pencil? And it says that it actually is. It's a good way to learn and to remember and to recall. And so hopefully you had a chance to read that. It's just a very quick article. But we do have that place in our bulletin each week where you can take some notes and write some stuff down. So if you want to take advantage of that, there's usually a pencil in the chairs that are in front of you as well. So as we go through this, we try to make it as plain as possible and putting up some notes on the overhead so that you can follow along and write some things as you go. So Psalm 42, for those who thirst this morning, and that is where we are going. So this morning we're carrying on our journey through the Psalms. We're going to look at the way in which they teach us how to pray, and each of these psalms that we're going through instructs us on prayer. In order to do this, I've selected a number of psalms from a variety of classifications. Last week, we looked at a psalm of penitence, of confession, and this week, we're going to look at a psalm of longing and of thirst, of course. And at one time, this psalm, which you just heard read, 42 and 43, were probably one psalm. You can see that as you look at these two psalms together. There's three verses between the two psalms. There's two verses in Psalm 42, and it appears to be that the third verse is Psalm 43. And there's a common refrain that's seen between these two psalms. So verse 5 in 42 and 43 is the same verse that is repeated. So they definitely work together as a cohesive unit. And what this psalm provides us with is the antidote for what it is that you long for. This is an amazing psalm of wisdom. It's wisdom that you can use in your own life, and it's a wisdom that you can offer to others. As we heard, when people speak to us, when we listen to others, it's always great to be able to offer something like this in the midst of people's turmoil. And this psalm lays out very clearly the reality that all of us face in a way that only biblical wisdom can. It's a multidimensional, and it's really a holistic in its approach, which gives it its ability to stand really outside of culture as a timeless truth. So this really is quite amazing. Now, this is a psalm for the despondent, for the one who is downcast, for the person who is struggling with depression or finding themselves in a low time, a desert wandering, or the one who is searching but never quite finding. Because this is the reality that all of us face at some point, and it's a reality even within our spiritual lives, when we feel spiritually dry at times. And I don't think there's anyone amongst us who has not experienced that, a spiritual drought that you have potentially walked through. You know, when we're doing this, we often say things like, you know, why do I not feel the way that I once did? Or why does God seem so distant in the midst of this thing that I am walking through? Why does it even just feel so distant at this point in my life? And even to the non-spiritual side of things, we can say these same things. Why does this experience that I am having not give me the satisfaction that I thought that it would? I thought this relationship would be what I needed, we might say or think. I thought this job would give me more hope and give me the happiness that I was counting on it for. See, questions that are common to the human experience, and that's what this psalm speaks to, because we all go through these times. So what we're going to do this morning as we go through this is we're going to look at the way in which it describes our condition. We're going to look at the diagnosis and the cause for it, and number three, the prescription for the cure for what this is, and one that is very practical and one that is very simple. And it offers it to us in a way that is quite profound. All of this as a way of forming our prayer life. So the first thing that we see here is our condition, and we find that, as I mentioned, in verse 5, which is the same in 42 and 43, which says, why are you cast down, O my soul? And why are you in turmoil within me? This is the condition that is so clearly laid out here. And the writer of this book clearly states that his soul is downcast. Now, the Hebrew word for this literally means to crumble or dissolve. There's a dissolving of the soul that is going on. It's wasting away, and that is experienced, and it is a metaphor for just giving up. We just can't go on any longer. My soul is wasting away. And there was a time when everything was vibrant, everything was good, everything was joyful. It was a time when he says he was worshiping community in Jerusalem, as we saw back in here in verse 4. You know, he said, I would pour out my soul. How would I go with the throng, lead them in the procession of the house of God with glad shouts and songs of praise, a multitude keeping festival. You know, there's this great celebration. He's looking forward to it. I guess maybe in our recent context, we could put of walking downtown to the whiteout, you know, on Wednesday or Friday. It's everyone's shouting and joyful. Hands are in the air. People are jumping up and down, and there's music playing, and we're having so much fun. We're looking forward to this experience. And believe it or not, this is what the psalmist says going to church is like. I remember when I went to church and I had my community around me and it was so much fun. It was so joyful and all of us were as one voice. We were lifting up this voice to God and we were praising and we were worshiping and he's looking back to this time. But now it's not so. Now he's removed from this. Now he's dry and he's very, very low. His soul is cast down. Now, we can have a tendency, I think, to look at this and to say, you know, that's not right. I mean, true believers, strong believers should never feel that way. If you're a Christian and if you're trusting in God, you should not feel that way, or something is very wrong with you or very wrong with your relationship with God. You need to start asking some very serious questions. Are you really a Christian? Are you really saved if you're experiencing this? But what we see is that this is a reality even for the strongest of believers to walk through these kind of times. Even for the ones that we might look up to in faith, this is common. No one is immune to these feelings of despondency, of being downcast. I mean, consider this as you look through the biblical testimony witness of these things. In 1 Kings chapter 19, after a great display of God's power through him, Elijah sits down under a broom tree. Like, this is one of the greatest things you see happening, a display of God's power through Elijah. He goes from that experience, he sits down under a broom tree, and he says to God, take my life. In Numbers 11, when the people cry out to Moses, give us meat in the wilderness, we're tired of eating this stuff, give us meat. And Moses is tired of hearing this groaning and complaining. He says to God, kill me at once. When God relents of the disaster against Nineveh, it causes Jonah to get so angry that he sits down under a plant in the hot sun. And then a worm comes up, that nasty little worm comes up in the midst of that heat and eats that plant and it withers and dies and the heat's pounding on Jonah and he asks God to kill him. It is better for me to die than to live, he says. These are the people that we look up to. You see, despondency, depression, it doesn't mean that you are far from God. It doesn't mean that you are beyond God's grace. It doesn't mean that you are beyond hope. It simply means you are experiencing what is common to the human experience, and God is with you, and there is a cure, which we will see shortly. But what all of these guys understand, I think, which is very interesting, as we look to these examples of people, the psalmist, Moses, Elijah, Jonah, they all understood that they had no right to take their own lives. They may have felt like it, but they didn't do it. They asked God to do it in their despondency, recognizing that this will be the only way that it can happen. Because there is a sanctity to life that God and God alone determines. And they see this and they understand this clearly, as do we. These guys are the best of the best. No one is immune from these feelings. And the feeling here is characterized by this term thirst. The psalm begins by talking about the way in which the deer pants, it thirsts for flowing streams, so my soul pants for you. In the same way that nature longs to be quenched is the way in which my soul is thirsting for you, O God. Three times this word thirst is used here. See, there's a thirst that is common to all human experience. We all thirst. No one who is sitting here this morning has never not thirsted. Deeply, and I don't mean just to be quench your physical thirst, but a deeper thirst that the psalmist is talking about. Even nature thirsts. The animals thirst until they find the water that will quench them. The deer pants because of this thirst. I was thinking about this week. Did you know that an elephant will drink about 50 gallons of water in a day? 50 gallons of water is a pretty big bucket of water. And they can get that down in about 5 minutes, so it doesn't take them very long. But they have extremely strong desire to fill themselves with a massive amount of liquid. They are so keenly attuned to it. They're so keenly attuned to water that they are thirsting for that they can actually smell water up to 20 kilometers away. Just think about that. They can smell water from 20 kilometers away, and they head off into the right direction. There's something like pretty grand at play there that allows them to be able to do this, wouldn't you think? I mean, just think of that compelling desire that they have to drink. I can smell a cheeseburger from about 10 feet away, but that's about it. 20 kilometers away. Just think of the singular focus that they have in their life, that drive towards this. Their existence depends upon it. Now, this word that is used here for thirst is this deep yearning from being massively dehydrated. Massively dehydrated, not just a little bit thirsty. Have you ever been that badly dehydrated and you had that kind of compulsion towards being quenched? Now, if you can imagine what this is like, this is the yearning that the psalmist has for God. He's experiencing this yearning, and he knows there's something that can satisfy it. That is the yearning that all of us experience, and we will not rest until it is satisfied. And we're going to try to do it any way we can. You do it too. Some of you recognize it's a spiritual thirst, and some of you do not. You experience it as something that must be filled. Because this is something within us that will not go being unfilled. You can't just continue on with this hole, this unfilled part of you, because something will always take it. It will not be left unfilled. Under any circumstances will it stay empty. That's the condition that we find here. And there's actually two things that are kind of interesting that we don't see here. Number one, we notice that there's no guilt. You know, last week we saw this confession, this penitence. There are other places where a wrong has happened, this deep remorse has set in, and it's led them to this. But here in this psalm, it's not a guilt. There's no sin that necessarily that we know of, that we can see, that led to this condition. And secondly, there's not a tragedy, and this is another thing that's common in the psalms. A big tragedy has happened, and so they feel this way. That's like what we see in Job, we might think of. But that's not the situation with this grief and with this despondency. Therefore, it shows that our human condition needs God. Basically, very basic to who we are, our human condition needs God just as much as we in nature need water. And this is what is being spelled out for us. So here's the diagnosis that we talk about. There seems to have been a few things at play here. And the first thing is that there's a change in setting. In verse 4, he says, I used to go to worship with a whole bunch of people, and we'd sing songs of praise, and it was awesome. But now he's north of Galilee, and it's not the same. There's no temple where he is now. There's no worship going on around him. And the people here are not into it. They are a totally different kind of people that he is around. Can you relate to that? You know, maybe you leave here on a Sunday, or you leave your life group, and the next day you go to work, or even you go into your home, it's so different than what you're experiencing. You go to your school, and it's not like it is. It's a completely different environment. It's discouraging. It's not good. It can feel very deep. It can feel very dark, and it can feel very hopeless. Maybe you experience this after coming back even from camp or Bible school. This is a common experience that many people have. You know, we used to actually sing this psalm at camp all the time, As the Deer Pants for Water. Did anybody here used to sing this song? Do you know this one, As the Deer? I mean, this was the quintessential camp song. If you really wanted to get kids crying and their emotions going, you just wait till the end of the week and everybody's sharing how great the week was and the spiritual high they're on, how much they're going to miss their counselor, and then you sing As the Deer, and it just brings everything down, and it's just this emotional experience, right? And these things can be actually like, they can be very powerful things in our life and in our faith development, but then we go away from it, and then we feel so different. And you go back to your regular place of worship or your regular home, and all of a sudden, it's not like it was. Why are things not like they were when I was there? So many of us have experienced that. We continue to hear about this time and time again, and I think there's a few reasons why this usually happens. I think one of them is that you've experienced it in a secondhand way. There are people around you who are experiencing the same things, and you're getting from them. You're understanding what it is that they have done, profound things that have happened to them, and that's influencing you. You kind of came at it, experienced it from a secondhand way. You saw it in others. You experienced it in others. You heard about it in others. So it came through the people who were around you, and then you move away from that, and those people aren't there anymore. See, it's important for us to take that step to establish your own relationship with God so we're not completely and only dependent on other people and those who are around us in worship and in prayer. This is because you're a social, relational creature. You cannot experience this in your own cell or in seclusion. You can't have all of it all on your own. It is so important that you do have good people around you. You need to be embedded in Christian community, or God will never become real to you in the same way. It'll reach its point where it cannot move further. You need others around you. Now, the other reason why this is happening, there's this change in setting that he's going through, but he's also now in a very hostile and unsupportive environment. So the change in setting is not a positive one. In verse 10, he says that these people, they taunt me all day long. They say to me, "Where is your God?" So he's being cast down for the things that he feels and believes and knows. Now, many of you live in such a work and an environment like that, or go to a school where this happens, and it can take its toil on you. It can cause you to become despondent, and it can make you think, "Am I crazy? Am I the only one that thinks this way here? And maybe it's me. Maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe there's something wrong with the way I think and these things that I believe," and it can start to get to us. It can cause you to become despondent and can make you think this way. Am I the only one who thinks this or believes this? This is the environment that the psalmist was in. The third thing he says here is that tears have been my food day and night. He's not eating. His tears are his food, and he's continuing to pour himself out. That means that he's just sitting alone. It looks like he's probably crying. He's sad. He's despondent, and he can't even eat. We would look at this and we would say, those are pretty common symptoms of depression. You know, this is the reality even for the strong believer, and we can become very moralistic sometimes in our response to this. We can say, well, you just need to pray more, or have you confessed, or have you claimed the blood of Jesus, or have you done this, or have you done that? And our response to it can become very moralistic in nature. But the Bible is actually deeply nuanced, and it doesn't always just offer this one simple, unsatisfying solution. You see, and the secular world would take a look at a problem like this as physical and physical only and would prescribe medication. But look again at 1 Corinthians 19. These are deep problems that are not just singular in focus. When Elijah is like this in 1 Kings 19 and he's asking for the Lord to kill him, the angel arrives. God sends this angel at just the right time, and he doesn't say to him, he doesn't say, "Get up, get going, what are you doing? Why are you doubting? Look at what you just experienced, look at what you just went through." No, the angel doesn't do that. You know what the angel actually does? He makes him a meal. The angel comes alongside him and said, "Here, have some falafel and some roast goat." He gently taps him on the shoulder and says, "Arise and eat, for this journey is too great for you." So Elijah, it says, he rises and he eats, and it says on the strength of that food, he goes for 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. You see, the problem was physical, the problem was spiritual, and the problem was emotional. It was on all of these fronts because it was the depth of the human experience that he was walking through. And that's how the wisdom of God's word explains these incredibly deep issues. Holistically, the Bible doesn't take just the reductionist approach in any of these things. You see, the deeper issue that we see here is that every human needs God. We see that even in the type of language that the psalmist uses here. The words of "I" and "me" that are seen all throughout this passage are deep words. These words have different intensive pronouns in the Hebrew, and here we find the deepest intensive. We're talking about the very core of who you are. When he says things like, "My soul pants, my soul thirsts, when shall I come and appear before God?" When he uses these intensive pronouns, they are on the level of identity. And this is where my thirst comes from. It's not just a physical thirst, but it's right to the very core of his identity and saying, "I need this thing from you, O God." For those of us who do believe, you have probably experienced this. "I wish that things were like they were with God at such and such a time and at such and such a place. We long for those experiences because this is at the core of our identity of who we are. Arguably, the greatest song that U2 has written and the one that resonates with the most people is the song, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. In this song, Bono sings about the experiences of this earth and how there must still be more. I've climbed the highest mountains, but I still haven't found this thing that I'm looking for. And it really draws in the human experience because so many feel this way. It's really the ultimate existential crisis that he is walking through, and he's asking these questions. I still haven't found it. It's a song of laments, like much of the Psalms and the Lamentations and Jeremiah. And I tend to think that potentially he may have gotten the idea in this song from a famous jazz singer of the 50s and 60s named Peggy Lee. She sang one of her most famous songs, Is That All There Is? Anyone here know that song? Is That All There Is? This is a very famous song. I'd actually never heard this song up until this week, and I said it to Tanya, and she's like, oh yeah, I know this song. She starts singing along to the chorus. I'm like, how do you know this stuff? Sometimes, like, I'm usually the guy that knows all the music, and for some, I don't know how, anyway, she knew this song. But it's a fascinating, fascinating song that really does explain so much of the human experience. And in her song, she laments at all these things that she's gone through. I'd actually encourage you, go on YouTube and take a listen. If you've never heard this song, it's worth listening to. She begins by saying that she remembers a time when she was a little girl and her house burned down. And she looks at these flames of this fire and she says, is that all that fire is? And then she has this experience where she goes to the circus with her father, the greatest show on earth. And she's holding hands with her father. And at the end of the circus, she just looks up and said, is that all there is? And then she gets to be an older woman. She has this, she becomes a woman, and she has this great relationship with a guy that she really, really loves. And he goes away, and she's despondent. But then she starts to think, is that all that love is? And then she kind of comes to the end of it, and she probably says something like, you might be thinking, why don't I just end it all? If I feel this way, why don't I just end it all? But she says something fascinating. She says, oh no, I'm no hurry to get to that final disappointment. One more place where she would say, is that all there is? It really does reflect, I think, the human experience. I don't know if you've ever gone through this before. If you've ever looked forward to something and you're thinking about it, and you're thinking about it, you're thinking about it, and you get it, and then all of a sudden it's like, is that all that this offers me? Could be a vacation. You could be just thinking this great experience. It could be a purchase. It could be all of these things, and all of this stuff is wrapped up in it, but then you say, is that all there is? It doesn't provide what we want for it to provide. This is so common to many of our experiences when we look deep. And at the end of that, her response is just to break out the booze, to keep on dancing, and have a ball. That's what it all comes down to. It sounds very much like Ecclesiastes, doesn't it? Why don't we just eat, drink, and be merry? This is the human experience. It's always disappointing. C.S. Lewis says it like this in his book, Mere Christianity. He articulates an argument for the existence of God based on our dissatisfaction. Is that the word? Doesn't sound right when I say it. He's dissatisfied with life, you know, and then this happens. As well, this also, it talks about our deepest desires that we have, and it sounds a lot like the lyrics to these songs. And I've mentioned this before, you've heard this before, but he says, a baby feels hunger, well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim, well, there is such a thing as water to satisfy that. Men feel sexual desire, well, there is such a thing as sex. And I could add to that a deer and an elephant, you know, experience the thirst of water, and there is such a thing as water to drink. And he says, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If you're looking for an experience that nothing has been able to satisfy, the most probable explanation to that is you were made for something greater, something more grand. Philosopher Peter Kreeft has reformulated Lewis's argument from desire into a syllogism that might be a little bit easier to follow, and he says this. You could break it down into this way. Every natural, innate desire corresponds to some real object that can satisfy that desire. Second, but there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, and no creature can satisfy. And therefore, there must be exist something more than time, earth, and creatures which can satisfy this desire. And this something is what people call God and life with God forever. This is the thing that really does exist, and our desires point us towards that reality. Well, there's a prescription and a cure for all of this, and here's what we have to do, and here's what we are called to do in this psalm. Pour out your soul. You see, the psalmist feels this way, and he prays. He pours it all out. And if you don't feel like praying, and there's times when it's hard to pray, and we're going through that desert time, that time when our soul is cast down, and it can be hard to pray, pray anyway. If he doesn't feel real, go to him and tell him that. Cry out to him and say that. We see the psalmist continually being real with their feelings and their emotions. They're saying things, and sometimes we look at them and say, should they be saying that? Is that okay to say? Because these are the experiences of reality that you're going through, and God can take it. Call out to him and say, God, I'm going through this. I'm walking through this. Would you help me? And reveal yourself. Continue to come time and time again. Don't stop doing that. You will decrease the amount of time you spend in that despondent place. And if you don't do it, it'll take much longer for you to get out of it. So continue to pour out your soul. Second, remind yourself of your hope in God. So you look at verse 5 and 6. He says, why am I downcast and in turmoil? Hope in God. I will remember your goodness. Always be preaching the gospel to yourself is what Paul Tripp is always saying, and it's true. See, if you don't talk truth to yourself, you will eventually go nuts. It's like this negative downward spiral if you're not focused on God's truth. And sometimes we can think things like, I'm not a good person. I can't be forgiven. There's nothing that can... God would not forgive me for the things that I've done if he only knew what kind of a person I was. And on and on and on. We can get ourselves thinking this way until we believe that it's reality. That's why we need truth. That's why we need God's word to turn us in a different direction. That negative downward spiral is very powerful. And so we need to focus on the good truths of God that we find in his word. See, the psalmist simply speaks to himself of the truth of God and his previous experiences with God. You need to remind yourself, but let me be perfectly clear in saying this also. It's not just about mustering up enough motivation and good thoughts and then saying them over and over again until we're healed and until we feel better. This is not a name it and claim it theology that the psalmist is talking about. The hope that is talked about in verse 5 of these chapters is a Hebrew word that actually means to trust and to wait. These are the words that lie at the foundation of this word hope, trusting and waiting. That means that I'm going to take an active stand and I'm going to trust and I'm going to wait in the Lord. This is not the hope of wishful thinking, but the hope of knowing that God has done great things and he will continue to do great things. I will actively wait. And this is tied to the last point, where it says that he meditates on God's unconditional love. That unconditional love of God, in verses 6 and 8, he says, by day the Lord commands his steadfast love, and at night his song is within me, a prayer to the God of my life. Day and night he's meditating on the word of God, and he's reminding himself of these things, and he's spending time just internalizing what it is that God has revealed to him. We see this so clearly at the cross. Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? He experienced being forsaken, alone, and he cries out and he says, I thirst. He's in this feeling of despondency and of aloneness and forsakenness, and he cries out and says that I thirst. Jesus was deserted, and he was feeling this ultimate thirst. He experienced this so that you would only have to temporarily experience it, and that the thirst that we have can be quenched. See, Jesus is the living water that quenches your thirst, and all throughout his ministry, he reminded all who are around him about this. In John 7:37, it says, on the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and he cried out, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Jesus is that ultimate fulfillment for the thirst that all of us long for. And then to further show this, that this isn't just this power of positive thinking that we're talking about here that will get you quenched on that thirst, the psalmist goes on to say in verse 40, in 43, verse 3, send out your light and your truth and let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill and to your dwelling. He is asking that the light and the truth that we know as Jesus Christ would lead us to his holy hill and into his dwelling. And in John 8, Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees still, and he tells them that he is the light of the world. Jesus says this, that he is the light of the world. He is the one who brings the light so that we can see. And then he says, if we abide in his words, we will know the truth, and the truth will set us free. He is that light. He is the quenching of that thirst. Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of this passage. He is the way to be quenched. Everything you need is found in him, but you must abide. You have to stop looking elsewhere. You have to stop trying to fill it on your own with the things that are around you, because you won't find it in your spouse. And if you try to find it in your spouse, you will find that you have placed such a heavy weight on them that they will be crushed by it, because they cannot be the one thing that will satisfy that thirst. You won't find it in a relationship. If you looked for it in a relationship, you will kill that relationship. You will be trying to suck way too much out of that relationship that it will end up destroying that relationship. You won't find it in money. You won't find it in power. They all have their ends. It will all come to an end, and you will end up saying, is that all that there is? It won't be in a job. Even the ideal job will not provide this for you. They will all leave you empty, and in the end saying, is that all that there is? Everything you need is in Christ. He is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the way to find this. He is the living water. So if you are a Christian hearing this passage this morning, continue to go to him. If you are finding yourself in the midst of darkness, in the midst of a time when you are low and you are feeling like God is so distant and you wish that he was the way in which he once was to you, continue to come before him. And in this month of prayer and fasting that we have right now, this is a great opportunity to do that. Continue to come to him and to call out to him, to cry out to him, to be honest with what you are experiencing, and ask him to be that fulfillment that it is that you need. If you've not yet come to Christ and you are hearing this passage, remember John 7:37, where Jesus says, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me. This is the invitation that Christ has given. And if you've experienced this, that you have a desire, that you have a thirst, Jesus says, I will meet this in you, and I will give you what your soul is ultimately longing for. There is no other way for this to be found. You were created for this. You experience this because you were created by God for him. You will never find that elusive thing that you were searching for until you find Christ, and then it all comes alive. If you're ready for that, please reach out to us. We would love to talk to you about this more. And, you know, there are those cards, I said, that are in the chairs that are ahead of you. Or you can just simply talk, give us a call, or write us an email. We would love to talk with you further about this if you were experiencing that and if you were seeing and considering Christ. I'm going to ask the worship team to come forward, and we are going to close in a song of just remembering this and calling this out to God. Never once did we ever walk alone. And so we are going to declare that God is in the midst of all that we walk through and all that we experience. And so we're going to ask that you would stand together as we sing this song as a declaration to the God who has provided these things for us. So let's stand together.
Thank you for tuning into the Ness Podcast. And be sure to check us out online at www.nessbaptist.com for all our past sermons. Ness Avenue Baptist Church, where we seek to equip people to love God and love others.